I thank you for the introduction and the invitation. I'll talk about mainly two papers, and somewhere in the background, there's a third paper with the mathematical foundations. But I'll focus mainly on the underlying physical principles and results. So the general question here is about the fundamental nature of time. And I want to start by pointing out that there is a difference between time and clocks, which we, I guess, in this area of quantum gravity, we haven't been very careful with. I think it's important to notice this because we all experience time. It's a very intuitive concept, but this only complicates the fundamental understanding. So what we really experience as time is a monotonic flow, but we use a periodic phenomena to measure what changes. And so I'll refer to these measurement devices or any underlying fundamental process as a clock. And what we construct or intuitively experience, I will just call time. And we can see that there are often contradictions in the intuitive notions if you just look at what we actually measure as time. At least the labeling we use to denote time is actually not monotonic, because it becomes monotonic only if we include at least the year, which we refer to as a date, not as time. So even our standard language and understanding does not carefully distinguish between periodic and monotonic phenomena. And because time is constructed, not just in the in these time and date labels, which are conventional, but also in a long time of evolution that probably led to, in some way, how we experience time. All these properties don't really tell us anything about what time is fundamentally. So it's an effective parameter. And all this leaves open the question whether time is fundamentally monotonic or periodic. Now, before we can answer this question, because in physics also we've for a long time just assumed that time is monotonic, and it's built into most of our theories that we use, we first have to check whether it can even be mathematically consistent to have a periodic clock underlying time. And that's what I'm going to do in this talk. Now, formally, these built-in monotonic ideas in our context are usually referred to as internal time. It's not always explicitly stated that it's monotonic, but in the end, usually in most formulations, it ends up being a monotonic parameter. So I'll start with a review of internal time deparameterization in different versions, relativistic, non-relativistic, and classical and quantum. And I'll point out difficulties that so far have required a monotonic understanding. The simplest case is a reformulation of classical non-relativistic mechanics. So in addition to the standard changing parameters like the position and momentum of a particle, we can also introduce a clock, a degree of freedom, not just as a parameter, which I call phi here. I guess that's cosmology notation, where it's often a scalar field. But at this point, it could be anything. And to make it turn into a degree of freedom, we need a momentum. And I guess even though it's non-relativistic, anticipating a little bit of what happens in relativity, the momentum gets a negative sign for time. So it's negative energy. And then the standard momentum is the momentum of the position. So it looks like we are doubling the number of degrees of freedom. But because the energy also appears in the Hamiltonian, which depends on Q and P, we get an additional constraint. So initially we're doubling degrees of freedom, and then we are cutting it back to the initial number of degrees of freedoms by imposing a constraint. So there's really just one independent variable, which would be the position if phi is time or clock. Now, there's nothing really that we can change if the setting is fixed, like non-relativistic mechanics. And all these equations imply that time has to be monotonic, because we can now construct Hamilton's equations from this constraint. And because the constraint is linear in the energy, Hamilton's equations directly imply that phi has to be a linear function of time. So this seems to require monotonic behavior. If we quantize the setting, it's basically the same result. In this case, we have operators. The sign here appears in the basic commutator. We have a constrained equation on acting on wave functions. And here, instead of Hamilton's equations, we can just use a phi representation for the energy operator, and we realize that that's just a standard Schrödinger equation, which also is based on a monotonic understanding of time. So that's one of the reasons why it often seems necessary to have a monotonic understanding. But the setting is still restricted here a little bit, because we it initially looks like we are putting time on the same footing as other degrees of freedom. But there's still differences. One of them is that phi doesn't fluctuate. That's clear from the relationship with the Schrödinger equation, where phi does not have, or time does not have fluctuations. And more generally, that's the mathematical part that I'm not going to talk about much here. It's implied by having this constraint operator. So the constraint removes time fluctuations. The other difference is that the constraint by construction in this non-relativistic setting is linear in E, which is one of the momenta here, but it's typically quadratic in P, the other momentum. So just algebraically, there's a difference. And this difference is relevant for this question about monotonic behavior. And we try to make this more general. We can go to a relativistic equation. And so one basic equation relates energy and momentum of a free particle. And that's already a place where we see the previous setting is not valid anymore, because that's everything here is quadratic. So that's a more equal treatment of the two momenta.
I'm sorry, you put a question to the end, or you want a question?
Go ahead.
You said that the time does not fluctuate, the position does, but I don't understand what you mean. If I, in standard Schrödinger theory, if you think of free particle, if you can ask where the particle is at some time, you get a fluctuation. If you ask at what time the particle is at some point, you get also fluctuations. So I don't see the distinction here. It's only if you use one as independent variable that you, so whatever you choose as independent doesn't fluctuate. Whatever you choose as dependent fluctuates. So it depends on the question, seems to me, not on the formalism of the physics itself.
Yeah, that's right. So that's related to questions how we transform between different time choices, which is something that I won't address here. But let's say you have chosen what your time is.
Okay, sure.
Then time doesn't fluctuate anymore. If you choose a different variable, then a different variable will be time, and that variable won't fluctuate anymore. And it's, of course, a complicated question how that's related to the first setting. But so somehow you'll have to transform a fluctuating variable into a non-fluctuating variable, and vice versa. So that's one of the difficulties. And but in a fixed setting, fixed choice of time, you also eliminate the fluctuations of this variable.
But if you have two particles, you ask where one is when, with respect to the other one, you have the same situation. It's not particularly difficult. Maybe I should, I don't want to go into a big discussion. I just wanted to get your view, your position.
We can keep the question for the end of the talk.
Yeah, we can come back to the later. But I think we agree. I mean, now I'm talking about a fixed choice. And in this setting, there's a difference between what we consider time and what we consider all the other variables. Now, in relativity, that's at least algebraically, it's more equal, because we have the quadratic dependence on the energy. And so I'm generalizing this this free particle equation here to something which can be used to extend the non-relativistic version if we factorize it, but still has a quadratic dependence on the energy. And now if we derive Hamilton's equations here, we can see that the situation is more flexible because d phi by dt is not a constant. When it's, well, first of all, it's not one necessarily. It's proportional to the energy, and the energy may not be constant if the Hamiltonian is phi dependent, so explicitly time dependent. So in this situation, it may be possible, first of all, it is possible to have two different signs for E as solutions of the constraint equation. And it may be possible to have evolution that connects between the two solutions, in which case we would have a periodic clock variable phi as a function of monotonic time t. So the strict relationship that d phi over dt has to equal one, which we had in a non-relativistic setting, can be relaxed. And that's relevant in cosmology, where in this case it's really more complicated because we have additional factors in Friedmann type equations compared with classical mechanics. But we usually have quadratic dependencies on momenta here, for instance, the scalar field that I referred to earlier. And if that's our clock variable, we can factorize the constraint and have two different solutions, plus or minus. With an explicitly phi-dependent Hamiltonian if the mass is non-zero. In most cases, in the past, people have set m equal to zero to simplify things. So in this case, it's a deparametrizable system. And phi would be monotonic. But if we think about this phi field here as a fundamental scalar field, then just using massless fields without self-interactions is not generic. So generically, we are in the situation in which we do have an explicitly time or clock dependent Hamiltonian. And in principle, that could be used to describe a periodic clock. Well, that's all classical. So if we try to quantize this, there seem to be additional difficulties with this periodic version. First, in the time-independent case, well, that's the easier one. In this case, we can exactly factorize even a constraint operator of this quadratic form into a plus E and minus E version. So from each of these factors, we get a Schrödinger equation, and combining both of them, we have the two signs for forward and backward motion. So we get a full cycle of the clock. In the time-dependent case, the factorization does not work exactly anymore because E and H don't commute. So we get a commutator term. And depending on which ordering we choose of the two factors to have the plus or minus version act directly on a state, we get different quantum corrections. So we can't use the same constraint operator to describe both half cycles, plus or minus H. So quantization then seems to make it impossible to have periodic clocks, even in the relativistic setting where classically it would be possible. Now at this point, that's where the older paper that I referred to is relevant. It's useful to extend the viewpoint here and bring in some ideas from path integrals, or more generally maybe ideas of from gauge theories applied to these constraint systems that we have here. In this case, we have a single constraint. And when we choose a time, let's say phi equal to t, then that's something that does not commute with any energy dependent constraint. So it's a gauge fixing condition. But it's not always a good gauge fixing. So the Poisson bracket of this gauge fixing condition phi minus t, and the constraint is 2e. And Also here, even though it's just classical, we can see the distinction between phi independent and phi dependent Hamiltonians. If H is phi independent, then E has a zero Poisson bracket with this constraint C prime here. So E is a constant, which means that the Poisson bracket up here is non-zero if it is initially non-zero. So phi minus T will always be a good gauge fixing condition. If H depends on phi, E is not constant, and it's possible for E to go through zero, in which case the gauge fixing condition is not good anymore. So in the language of gauge theories, we have a Grieber horizon because our gauge fixing breaks down. So that's happening at E equal to zero as a submanifold of our phase space. Now, so that's a common phenomenon in gauge theories and quantization. And one of the lessons is that we should not cross any Grieber horizon. So any path integration should be restricted to a single Grieber region, which can be obtained by not crossing any Grieber horizons. And that's necessary because otherwise we would overcount degrees of freedom and we would not obtain the correct value of our path integral. So in our case, that means we have to fix the sign of E. So we can only stay on one side of E equal to zero. But then we're back to the problem, how can phi oscillate if we cannot change the sign of its momentum? Now, all this is based, notice up here, on our old gauge fixing condition, phi equal to t. So in a sense, it's not surprising that we don't get oscillating phi because our gauge fixing choice implicitly assumes that phi does not oscillate. It's strictly proportional to a monotonic parameter. So to solve this problem, which is actually pretty simple with hindsight, we have to choose a more general gauge fixing condition. We have to choose something which runs along with tau. Tau is now my notation for a global parameter that works even in oscillating cases. So it's still time, but I use tau to distinguish it from the strictly monotonic t case. So in some regions of our dynamics, we might have phi running along with tau. In other regions, it might have to run in the opposite direction because phi might be an oscillating clock. And then A plus and A minus are constants which we can choose to have a continuous relationship. So this would still be a gauge fixing condition. It would be different at different times, but that's okay. So at any fixed tau, it would still be a valid gauge fixing condition. So if we adjust the constants to a specific model, we have can require that tau is really strictly monotonic. So this would be our effective time parameter, even if phi is periodic. So we have something like a periodic clock, which rolls on a linear scale and imprints a monotonic time label. Well, there's one difference which we can see immediately, a small difference. It's just a sign, but it's important. If we try to rewrite our previous deparameterized Schrödinger equation with respect to tau instead of phi, I'm sorry, I think I clicked something. Can you still see my slides? Well, I don't see them.
No, we see your screen.
Okay, I think there it is.
Okay, so there is a quick question by Bianca.
So Martin, if I understand correctly, A plus or A minus is something which is kind of, is it phase space dependent or not?
They might be phase-based dependent. Yeah, it really depends on the specific clock Hamiltonian that you use, because it depends on
maybe,
the...
Maybe you come to this example. So if I have a system which is completely periodic, this construction, because phi is periodic, but tau is something linear, so A plus needs to somehow count the number of periods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Isn't it this assumption that you can do that for a physical system? I mean, if we are in a cyclic universe, how do we count the number of cycles? Well, maybe you're going to discuss that, or that's...
Well, yeah, I think the assumption here that it is possible to have an effective monotonic time parameter. Uh-huh. So if in your example, that assumption would be violated.
Okay.
And then it might not be possible to construct something like this.
Okay. So it was something, it seems something important to me. So you assume that one can count in a periodic system the number of oscillations, even if, say, standard phase space does not really provide this information.
Right. Well, I mean, I would say I'm assuming that it's in your classical system, you have a monotonic time parameter that runs from negative infinity to positive infinity.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to reconcile this with a periodic clock.
Uh-huh.
I haven't really thought about anything which does not, where even your, any time you can construct would be periodic in some way. And then
if you couple two harmonic oscillators, I just don't know whether this example is relevant or not, but you know, that would be an example where phase space itself, it's everything is periodic, but you can imagine that you can count the number of periods.
Yeah, that's actually, well, I mean, we might want to wait until I come to the specific example, because it is something like two oscillators.
Okay, thank you.
And in this case, you can construct a plus and a minus such that they you do have a reference to the number of cycles. But yeah, let me, that will be in a few slides. So let me just finish the general equations here. So with this new type of parameterization, we can simply use the chain rule to rewrite our previous phi version of the deparameterized Schrödinger equation in terms of tau. And the only difference is an extra sign. So the previous E is only is the actual Hamiltonian up to only up to a sign factor, which depends on which cycle we're in. And that's also consistent with the path integral picture. So here's the general equation for transition amplitude in a constraint system. It's a single constraint C, which appears in the exponent. Again, a negative E here for the phi and its momentum. And then the gauge fixing condition, this Poisson bracket here appears in the measure. It's imposed by a delta function, the gauge fixing condition. And then the step function here, theta function, restricts us to a single Grieber region at each time. So I left the choice open, so it might depend on the time value. So after we integrate over n, most of it is standard. So we get a delta function for a constraint. The constraint is imposed, which means E is plus or minus H. And the E phi dot term is then turned into the Hamiltonian for a QP system. And also here it has a sine factor defiably tau from phi dot. So this means that in the setting with this more general gauge fixing condition, phi can oscillate. And even if we impose a positive Hamiltonian, say we have a stable system, we want the QP Hamiltonian to be positive. This means that E times d phi over d tau has to be positive, but that still allows for both signs of E or d phi over d tau. So we can restrict ourselves to a single Grieber region at each time, and still have the corresponding sign changes of the phi over d tau. And then each cycle will require a different Grieber region, so that's okay because it's at different times. And to have complete evolution through all cycles, we can just use composition of these transition amplitudes to have global evolution. So that's the general theory. And now our main example here. So that's, well, at this point, I only fix the clock system. H is still arbitrary for some time for the next few slides. And the clock system is an oscillator. So it's quadratic in E and phi. And there's no additional phi dependence in H. So there's, in some sense, minimal coupling between time and the system just by imposing the constraint or energy balance. It's easy to see that H is constant by Hamilton's equations. And for a given solution, we have turning points of phi at plus or minus that constant value of h divided by lambda, some kind of frequency in the system. So since h is constant, it's easy to plot orbits in the time plane. So it looks like a pretty simple system classically. But it turns out quantum mechanics is more difficult, and in particular in the case in which lambda is large. So this would be a small clock period, which would be interesting in fundamental applications. So if we have a fundamental period close to Planck time, then the phi period should be small, so lambda should be very large. So this would be the case that we're interested in, but for now we can leave lambda as a general parameter. Solving the equation in the quantum case, initially usual procedure is we would use stationary states of our H Hamiltonian. And then solving the constraint gives us a simple constant multiplier of each stationary state on the Schrödinger equation. It's phi independent, so it's not, it's constant, it's not an operator anymore in this version, but it still depends on phi. But this expression can be integrated analytically, so we get a phase, which is kind of a complicated function, but still in closed form. So whenever we can use a single sign of E, we have this function, which replaces the standard linear dependence of the phase on time. But it's not possible to extend this to global evolution because for fixed energies, fixed stationary state, phi can have only a finite range with real phase. And so the restriction on the range is exactly the turning point values we obtained earlier, so energy over lambda. So in this case, because the clock is periodic, phi evolution is not unitary, but we can now introduce our more careful parameterization. So this is like before, so tau or minus tau with certain constants. So as Bianca pointed, constants, it's not tau dependent, but it might still be phase space dependent. So here, it's really in terms of phi t, which is the turning point value, which depends on Ek or H, the Hamiltonian, which then classically would depend on QNP. So it is phase-based dependence, but in terms of tau, these are constants. And that's an example in which we can construct the number of cycles from the tau value. So tau here would be our monotonic effective time parameter, and phi runs back and forth depending on the cycle. And you can check that's a monotonic choice here of these constants. So since tau is can take any real value, we would have global evolution with respect to this parameter. In this case, we have the additional Fiorotti tau factor in the Schrödinger equation. But we can align the sign choices of E and Fiorotti tau such that the Hamiltonian is always positive. So it looks just like the system we solved previously for a single stationary state. But when we integrate now, we have to take into account an additional sign factor because phi of tau might be increasing or decreasing. So the only difference we have with the previous solution for a stationary state is that we have the additional sign factor in the phase. So whenever phi runs through a turning point, we have a reflection of the phase. And because phi of tau by construction is always between turning points, this evolution here is unitary. So at this point, we've shown that periodic clocks make sense. We have unitary evolution for the system here. And phi is our clock variable, tau is different, is an effective monotonic time parameter. Now, it's much more complicated to understand what's happening if we don't have stationary states anymore. Of course, as usual, we can use superpositions to construct any state, so any initial state, and then let all the contributing stationary states evolve independently. But because the turning point conditions are phase-space dependent or energy dependent, EK dependent, each stationary contribution will go through its turning points at different times. And so these phase reflections happen at different times for different stationary contributions, which means we would expect that they quickly run out of phase if initially there were some kind of coherence. And that's indeed what we saw when we started doing numerics, because analytically it's complicated to understand these phase changes. So we started doing numerics. In that case, of course, we have to specify the Hamiltonian as well, which is also a harmonic oscillator. And we chose initial values, which were standard coherent states for a standard harmonic oscillator. So but normally, if there's a global time, we would expect coherence to remain intact forever. But that doesn't happen here, as can be seen in this diagram very easily. Here, lambda is 1/10, so not very large. And so that means at about tau equal to 10, we expect the first turning point to occur and the corresponding phase reflection. That's about here. And soon afterwards, the system runs out of coherence. So that's what we expect, because once different stationary contributions have gone through different phase reflections, they are not in coherence anymore. So that's seen here for the density plot of the wave function. And on the left here, that's the plot where we have position and momentum expectation values on the horizontal plane, time running upwards, and the colors indicate increasing fluctuations and it gets more yellow. So again, quickly, a decoherent system, even though for a standard harmonic oscillator, the initial state would have been completely coherent. The next plot looks like something where we think it should be lambda equal to zero. We have perfect coherence, but that's actually obtained for a huge value of lambda, 10 to the 10. So that means during a single period of the oscillator, we run through billions of turning points. And initially we would have thought we run out of any coherence that might have been there in the initial state should have disappeared very quickly. But somehow, when all these reflections happen so frequently, a coherence is restored. And even if we extend the numerics to larger and larger time values, you would not be able to see any decoherence. And that's also seen here down there in the picture. So that was the first surprise of the numerics. Still surprising, so we don't really have a full analytical explanation for why that's happening, why coherence is restored almost perfectly for very large lambda. But we were able to explain a few properties analytically. And one of them is a difference that we can actually see here in these plots, not just coherence, but if I flip back and forth, you can see that it looks like the period is increasing for larger lambda, even though we use the same frequency parameters up here. So in the small lambda case, the first period, which is still pretty coherent, ends at about 6, which is close to 2 pi. In this case, it's closer to 10, it's actually about 8. And that's something that can be explained using the equation for the clock cycles, which I had previously as a function of tau. So that follows from our parameterization. And for large lambda, it can easily be approximated by including only the second factor here, or the second term of the sum, rather. And then if we have the number of clock cycles, we can compute the accumulated phase, because we know we have this complicated nonlinear expression for the phase previously. So we can compute how much phase accumulates in a single cycle. And that's twice the difference of the phase values of the two turning points. And then just multiplying by n gives us the total accumulated phase. And then again, with simplifications here for large lambda, that's equal to something linear in time. And it's almost equal to the standard phase, energy time over h bar, except there's an extra factor of pi over 4. And this pi over 4 is exactly the factor that turns a 2 pi, the standard period, into an 8, which is what we saw on these in the numerics. So this can be explained. Well, it's interesting to see how that happens in not just in numerics, but also analytically. But that can't be used to extract any observable phenomena because we have the same factor for any system once the clock Hamiltonian has been fixed. So the factor here, this pi over 4, could just be absorbed in all the bare frequencies of our systems, any system that we might want to consider, and everything would be rescaled in the same way. So this would not be observable because we could not compare or read off such a factor by comparing different systems. But there's something else that's observable, and it's also related to the nonlinear phase, which implies that we have a non-zero standard deviation between the phases in each cycle, or even a quarter cycle, just from zero to a turning point. So we define this up here. So we use the accumulated phase. Question, Bianca?
Bianca, you have to mute yourself.
Sorry. So you're saying basically that actually the system I want to observe, which is a second oscillator, that's just influenced by the first system and its dynamics, even so it's completely uncoupled.
Well, there's no force that couples the two systems, but it's and the constraint is like a coupling term. So the systems are able to exchange energy.
Yeah, but it seems so. I mean, does it come from this description of adding of UV, of adding of making of adding tau and having these phase shifts? I mean, that seems to be behind that, no?
Yeah, the coherence effects are in the phases, which is one of the reasons why it's still difficult to explain precisely what's going on. But it's it's non-phase reflections.
I do assume, because you mentioned that's one to one with a path integral description, with your description of Grieber horizons.
Yeah, I mean that's mainly motivation. So the what we use in the numerics is, for the numerics.
I'm just asking if this description, which you say, if your canonical way to describe it is consistent with your path integral way.
Yeah, it's, we could just refer to transition amplitudes and you can compute them canonically or using a path integral. And then the other important ingredient is the sine factor, which we get canonically just from the chain rule here, it's phi over tau. And in the path integral, it's from the symplectic term, e times phi dot. Yeah, so path integral and canonical is completely equivalent here. I'm just emphasizing both of them because it's there's a new interpretation. Path integral would require a new setting up a new gauge fixing condition, and canonically, it's I think it's more a parametrization that allows us to stay between the turning points at all times to have unitary evolution. It's consistent, and what we actually used in the numerics is really basically this equation here. Or not even solving. We were able to use these analytical solutions, but then we have to put together the sine reflections for each stationary state and then sum them up. And that's where it is just difficult to see what happens analytically. And that's also in the next property here, which we can do a little bit analytically. So let me first go through that part. So the so we defined the variance here of the phase variations by integrating or averaging the squared difference of the actual nonlinear phase minus the linear accumulated phase, which we computed up here. Now that's, remember the nonlinear expression is pretty complicated, but still possible to integrate this analytically, and that's the result. And if we, now everything still refers to the energy of a single stationary state, but with h bar, that's just the system period for harmonic system. And the remaining EKs, which can be combined, the four factors of EK only two h bars, but EK over lambda is proportional to our turning point value, which is proportional to the clock period. So it's possible to rewrite this as an equation just relating the clock period, the system period, and the variance. And numerically, there's a factor of about 10. So this means if let's say we can measure the system period very precisely, that might refer to an atomic clock. And we also have the accuracy of the clock, which would be sigma, then we can estimate how large the clock period could be. So if sigma is very small, the measurement is very precise, then we get an upper bound on the clock period. And the values here depend on the specific harmonic clock system, but the qualitatively the effect depends only on the fact that we have a nonlinear phase. And that's true for any dynamical clock Hamiltonian. So that's pretty generic. Now I evaluate this a little bit more in terms of actual numbers, but also here, it looks like it's a complete analytical understanding, but what we actually do here is we just average over a quarter cycle. So the actual calculation does not really refer to what we see here, something coherence maintained over many cycles. But numerics helped us to show that there is a relationship between this quarter cycle calculation and long-term evolution, and that's shown here. Analytical, the straight line refers to what we calculate on the previous slide. And numerical refers to the variance actually computed from long-term evolution, where we treated a large number of periods for large lambda, or well, any specific value of lambda here in this range, as a statistical ensemble and computed the variance. And there's very close agreement. The spikes numerically are just because it gets very difficult for large lambda to resolve all the periods. But clearly the upper bound is exactly in agreement with the analytical equation. So that's really, that should suggest that the analytical value really tells us something about long-term measurements over many clock cycles. Now, what does that tell us about specific measurements? So again, this just use the simple relationship here. If we can measure TS and sigma, we get an upper bound on possible clock periods. The latest results for atomic clocks, they operate at about 2 femtoseconds system period, not very small. So that's in the visible range of light. But sigma gives us a very tiny suppression factor. So the upper bound that we get for this, for just being able to maintain this accuracy in atomic clock measurement tells us that the clock period, if there's a fundamental clock, cannot be greater than about 10 to the negative 33 seconds, which is still more than 10 orders of magnitude above the Planck time, but compared with other time measurements, it's pretty good. The smallest direct measurement of time was done just last year photon travel time across the hydrogen molecule is more than 10 orders of magnitude above our upper bound. And other indirect measurements at particle accelerators, one measures cross sections. So indirectly, this can be translated into a distance measurement or time measurements. And here it amounts to 10 to the negative 28 seconds, so 5 orders of magnitude above our upper bound. So with the indirect effect that we have here, this additional coherence or decoherence over really a large number of cycles, we can even improve the another indirect bound from high energy physics. I think I'm almost out of time, so I'll just have a few slides to indicate what we've been doing since the paper was published. Here are a few plots for systems where H is not a harmonic oscillator, and we can see the same kind of effect. So on the left is a smaller lambda, right is large lambda, not as large as in the previous case, but one can see that it does also get more coherent in this case. So in this case, we had a hydrogen Hamiltonian. So similar effects appear for atomic systems. We've also been thinking about cosmology and the additional factors first in the actual Hamiltonian. So it's still quadratic and phi and p phi, which is a scalar field as a clock. But the additional volume factors, which are phase-based variables. So it's different from the clock Hamiltonian that we considered in the oscillator example. So in cosmological evolution, there is, classical equations would have additional friction terms based on these V factors, which means that phi doesn't really oscillate if the Hubble parameter is very large, large curvature. So if we have the Planck density, it's actually, even with the extra V dependence or a mass term, it is allowed to use a monotonic clock, but only for a finite range. So it would not be complete unitary evolution. But deparametrized models seem to describe this pretty well, as long as we stay close to high density. But then as the volume increases, curvature goes down, there will eventually be turning points for phi, but only a few. So this would correspond to the small lambda case where we have enhanced decoherence. In this quantum cosmology state. So one possible application, which we haven't really analyzed yet, but just as maybe a positive outcome, this might at some point be used to wash out Trans-Planckian features. So if we have additional decoherence, then maybe the system is less sensitive to Trans-Planckian effects that happen at high density. And after this transition region, the system will stabilize, coherence will stabilize, because we will be back at a situation which corresponds to a large lambda in the oscillator system. And then we can, again, have long-term coherence. Another cosmological application, we've seen that there's a non-zero variance of a system period. And it appears like a statistical ensemble. So in some kind of effective treatment, this suggests additional stochastic terms in cosmological equations, which haven't been considered so far. So usually stochastic terms in cosmology are included in a potential, not in time derivatives. But here, because the stochastics is in the period, we would have a noise term multiplying all the time derivatives. So this refers to a system in which we do quantize both terms, but in terms of wave functions, it's more difficult than the oscillator system because we again have these extra V factors, and that means that this V here in the clock term, in the clock Hamiltonian, does not commute with the system Hamiltonian. So in this case, we're not able to use this decomposition into stationary states as in the oscillator system, which means numerics is much more complicated because we have to diagonalize the system at every time step. So it's much more expensive computationally. We've done just a few cases, small numbers of stationary states. And these are two examples, small and large lambda. So we can see something like the rescaling effect previously. And here's an intermediate lambda where we have or expect more decoherence. And looks like this can have an effect on the expansion rate. But this is preliminary stuff because we haven't been able to analyze large discretizations. So just to end now, some open questions. Of course, cosmologically, it would be interesting to include inhomogeneity and see how maybe what these oscillations, what implications they could have for structure formation. But it's unlikely that this can be done for a complete wave function. So at this point, we would need a good effective theory that describes these phase reflections, which we don't understand very well yet. So there's it's not a standard effective theory. So that requires new methods. And then, of course, the questions of transformations between different clocks, which I haven't talked about at all. And we haven't thought about how that could be done in this setting. Okay, so that's all I have. Thank you for your attention. So.
Yeah, thank you, Martin, for this very interesting talk. So I'm unmuting now, everybody.
I have a question.
Yes, so one second. So I would first ask if there are questions from students. So this seems not to be the case. So there is already an anonymous question that I'm now also copying here in the chat. And I'm reading it. So it says, in the condensed matter context, we treat imaginary or big rotated time as compactified in order to obtain observables such as the effective electron propagator. After a Fourier transform, these quantities are expressed in terms of the discrete Matsubara frequencies. If the clock is periodic, is there a corresponding notion of a discrete Fourier clock? And if so, what would mean physically? And so you have to unmute yourself now, Martin.
Okay, and then go back to slides. Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't really thought about this relationship. I would think that, I'm certainly in condensed matter, what happens can be described to a very good degree using tau, so our effective global time parameter. And so far in our systems, we've included the fundamental clocks with the variance. It would be an additional fluctuation, but it would not actually be a strictly periodic time. So that's, again, that's the where the distinction between time and clocks is relevant. So the so for us, we have a periodic clock. We don't have periodic time. And I think that's why we don't have the, we would not have the a discretization in the frequencies if we applied that to condensed matter systems.
Okay, so thank you for replying this question. So I hope this answered the question, and if the person who posed the question wants to follow up, please do it now. Okay, so he or she seems to be happy with your answer. And so now there are two more questions. The first by Carlo.
Thank you, Alessia. And Martin, that was clear, and I tried to listen very carefully. Provided I've understood what to say, I'm not convinced. And let me tell you why I'm not convinced. And you can tell me a few things differently. It seems to me that there is a conceptual problem in what you're doing. In fact, a key conceptual problem, or if you want two that change the situation. You use two notions, clock and time, right? And it seems to me that you're making a mistake in both. And let me tell you which are the two mistakes. First, let's talk about clocks. Clock is the device we use to measure time, right? That's what we. And we have this intuitive idea that clock is periodic because, in fact, we use periods for we use a pendulum or an oscillator for measuring time. However, and that's a key point, it has been observed many times, and it is in the literature. I mean, it's discussed by Eddington. There's a beautiful page by Feynman on that. You can even find it online. A clock cannot be an exactly periodic system. You just cannot measure time with an exactly periodic system. In fact, if even stronger, you cannot have a purely mechanical system in the sense that without dissipation to measure time. If you look carefully at the physics of the escapement of the Huygens pendulum, it wouldn't work without a little bit of heat being dissipated every step. And it's exactly the heat that allows something to go ahead rather than coming back. So you have dissipation. But even, I mean, in principle, you don't need heat. You just have something that accumulates, okay? At every period, you add one. So real clocks, or true clocks, what we call clocks, are not periodic systems. Are systems that exploit some periodicity, but if they were periodic, they wouldn't be clocks. Now that's the first point. And I think
let me just end on this.
Because it goes together with the second. It goes together with the second, otherwise it doesn't work. So in the physical system, like this one, there is something periodic, a little thing that oscillates, and there is something non-periodic that opens up this periodicity, which is something physical, some physical variable. Okay, good. So second point, that's about your notion of clock. Now then about your notion of time. You said, well, whatever is our system that we call clocks and variable, but we have a notion of a time which is not doesn't come back, which is monatomic, which is global, that's fine. I agree that this is part of our notion of time. But if I am given a physical system and one of your constrained systems, and as you know, I think that the constrained language that you're using is a correct one, is the best one for describing nature. We were fully on the same, we agree on that completely. If we are given that, that's the world which are describing. So if in that constrained system that we are considering, the orbits are open, then I can have a notion of time, global and monotonic. But if the orbits are closed, in whatever way they're closed, the idea that, okay, the system has this closed orbit, but in reality, if you think classical, I think something can go over and over again, and therefore actually beyond, over and beyond the variables themselves, there's also not just a phi, but also a tau. So I have to, you know, do some tricky with the formalism in the quantization to separate one term from the other. I think this is wrong because, in reality, if I look in just on my clock and something that falls, there is much more, there is already some other variables that separate one orbit from the other. But if the system I'm describing is just as closed orbits, is periodic, then it does not describe something in which you can separate the different periods one from the other. So once you, in your formalism, you introduce the time gauge, and the phi equal tau, so you introduce tau, and then you want to separate tau from one orbit to the other, so you do this tricky thing, you're just messing up what the system described. That's not what described the system, and you're introducing some effect, which is not physical.
Is that the question?
No, that's my, it's not a question, it's my, this, you make a seminar and that's my reaction. And if you have, if you disagree, I'm happy to hear where. It's not a question, it's a statement.
Well, it's actually a simple answer. So I use the strictly periodic system because it's harmonic. That's always what we look at first. But I emphasized this on this slide here. The only real condition is that we have something, some interacting clock Hamiltonian that produces a nonlinear phase. So even if it's not strictly periodic, you would still have a nonlinear phase and you would have a variance like in this case here. So I never required that we need a strictly periodic system as a clock. You can try whatever you prefer as a more realistic clock description. In fact, in the cosmological model, we don't have a strict a strictly periodic system because of the volume dependence. So at different volumes, different times, the period will be different. It's no longer strictly periodic. So that's only an assumption in the simplest model that we could construct and analyze. It doesn't mean that it has to be like this in all systems in which such a periodic clock description applies.
Yeah, but nothing what I said depends on being strictly periodic. It just depends on the on whether phi comes back or not. What I'm saying is that there's no tau in the universe. There are only phis. And in fact, you can take your systems, never introduce a tau, never introduce a gauge fixing, write transition amplitude as they were, and that's the physics, that's the quantum physics described by that constrained system. I think that if you force the introduction of a tau, you force a gauge fixing, it's not an issue of exact periodicity or not. It's separating the different sort of phase space positions with the same variables, the same phi and the same other variables. You shouldn't, if your system has that phase space. You're bringing back a time from a pre-relativistic notion somehow, from a non-constrained perspective. And you want to bring your intuition about something else beyond what the system describes, and that creates an artificial effect, in my opinion.
Well, we introduced tau to primarily to show how you can get unitary evolution.
Exactly, no unitary evolution in a constrained system in general. There is if, and to the extent in which there is a parameter with respect to which. In your closed system, there's no sense as a periodic evolution. There's an approximate periodic evolution step by step with respect to a variable until the turning point. Unitary evolution is not there in the usual sense. This is the universe in the sense that probability is concerned, but there's no unitary evolution in time if there's no time global.
Right, if there's no unitary evolution, there's no unitary evolution. I agree. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry for interrupting this discussion, but there are also other questions. So Bianca comes next.
Yeah, maybe I kind of continue or comment shortly because what Carlo says is the second part. It was connected to my first question. Which was, you know, can you actually count n? And I think that's somehow an additional assumption. But Martin, you also said it's consistent with the Skribov horizon description of path integrals, if I understand it correctly.
Yeah.
So can you say?
It's an extension. I think in the strict treatment, the difference is that we have a time-dependent gauge fixing, which you don't have in the standard treatment of Grebov horizons.
Uh-huh. And maybe you can say a bit about the motivation, because you mentioned it does avoid that you count degrees of freedom or integrate several times about the same degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
Can you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, I don't have an example here. Okay. Okay. That would happen if you, so let's fix tau. So at a fixed time, it will be a standard treatment. In that case, we have to insert the theta function here, because then the QP part of the path integral is restricted to a single Grieber region at a fixed time. If we did not include the theta function here, we would include both positive and negative E at the same time. And that would be overcounting degrees of freedom or solutions of our constrained equation.
And at
different times, we can choose a different Grieber region. So that's that's a new part here, because we have a time-dependent gauge fixing.
And I think like these comments about what clocks are, I guess it works that you have a quasi-periodic clock, but actually you couple it to another system, which gives you the counting of the periods.
Yeah, you need or just degrees of freedom, additional degrees of freedom, which can somehow keep track of.
So in this case, yeah. So if you have a physical degree of freedom which counts, and would you expect the same kind of effect, or would it be completely different?
No, I would expect the same effect, because again, everything is really contained in the fact that we get a nonlinear time dependence of the phase. And that's true. That would be even more nonlinear if you have these additional interactions.
Okay, and a last question, because it's at Watchers, which came up because popular science journals asked me about that. So if you say the smallest period of time, that's different from the smallest amount of time, you know, because you can have a larger period, but you could measure smaller amounts of time which are smaller than the period of time.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that would work, because then you would need a system that really keeps track of the phi motion.
Yeah, the main would be the monotonic piece, kind of.
Yeah, and I think that would then probably require stronger interactions.
System
and clock.
Okay, thank you.
But yeah, maybe a related comment. There's a difference between the periodic time and discrete time.
Yeah. Okay.
Are there more questions or comments? Okay, so if not, let's thank Martin again for this nice talk and discussion session.